This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a new charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
One can't prove that God doesn't exist, but science makes God unnecessary. The laws of physics can explain the universe without the need for a creator.
Well, that, of course, is the familiar voice of scientist Stephen Hawking. God is no longer necessary. Science has displaced him. I've read, a fair number of Stephen Hawking's popular works. Cannot say I could begin to understand any of his scientific works, but his popular works are rather enlightening if you want to know about theories regarding the origin of the universe and the cosmos and these things. It's fascinating reading. And it's an interesting statement for someone dedicated to pure science to make, that they have managed somehow to rule God out of the universal equation. Joining us on this Friday afternoon, September the 10th, for the remainder of this first hour, to talk about these statements made by scientist Stephen Hawking regarding science and God, Dr. Angus Manoush. He's professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and editor of the book Reading God's World, The Scientific Vocation. Dr. Manoush, welcome back.
Glad to be back, Todd.
How do you initially respond to Stephen Hawking when he says that science has, we've learned enough through science to essentially no longer need the God explanation in our study of the world around us?
Well, he's really repeating the idea of Pierre-Simon Laplace when Napoleon asked him where God was in his system of the universe. He said, I no longer have need for such a hypothesis. But what Laplace and Hawking don't seem to see is the very fact that they can devise an orderly system provides evidence of a creator, and also the fact that their own reason was able to discover it should tell them something rather remarkable about the human mind. In other words, the two most remarkable things are, why is there an orderly universe instead of a chaotic one? And why is the human mind able to discover some of that order? And it seems to me that both of those point very strongly towards God's existence. Albert Einstein famously said, a priori, one should expect a chaotic world which cannot be grasped by the mind in any way. The kind of order created by Newton's theory of gravitation is wholly different. While substitute Hawking's more sophisticated theory of quantum gravitation, and the same point will apply.
Many people stand in awe of a man like Hawking, who has, of course, building on the work of many others, been able to articulate scientific theories so complex. And hopefully understand them, although I imagine that in the realm of theoretical physics, few would claim to truly understand the theories that they espouse. They say, look, Hawking says this. This is one of the brightest scientific minds of our age. That must count for something. What's your response?
Yeah, the thing is that there are so many different models. What people don't realize who haven't looked into cosmology yet is that there are so many different ones. For example, in his new idea, he claims that every possible history of the universe exists simultaneously, which sounds rather like Everett's many-universe model. And he also, in the past, has suggested, well, there's no one beginning point to the universe, because we can use imaginary numbers, and then there is no particular place where it begins. It begins in many places. All of these moves by Hawking are very controversial, even among other secular cosmologists. And, of course, the problem is, how do you actually provide any hard evidence to test between these theories and say that any one of them is right and the other ones are wrong?
It strikes me that Hawking, at least in that respect, is perhaps emblematic of the whole discipline that he finds himself in, theoretical physics, that it's kind of a playground for whatever you would like to propose, because there is so little way of experimentally verifying anything that they propose by way of theory, especially for origins.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many degrees of freedom, and when one makes claims about multiple universes or multiple histories of the same universe, it's fairly obvious that we're never going to be in a position to directly test any of this, because by definition, those universes or those histories are not accessible to us. And so there's a concern, if you would bring these models into a court of law, I think that the judge would be minded to dismiss them as a speculation, unless someone can show how he can really test them.
He, of course, stands alongside the others you have mentioned, and more popular views espoused by atheists today, popularized by Richard Dawkins and others, who quite confidently say that God is no longer a necessary idea. We have better explanations than God. Is God simply an explanation for those things we can't understand?
Well, I mean, God does explain certain things, and one of the problems with his argument is that even if God plays no role in his theory, we need an explanation of why it's possible to come up with rational theories. But as well, there are many other things which God is brought in to explain, such as morality, consciousness, and perhaps most profoundly of all, reason. The argument from reason is a way of comparing an atheistic with a theistic view and saying, well, on which worldview is it most likely that reason is reliable? See, now these are all foundational background questions. They're things that you have to assume before you do science. Presumably, we think our reason is reliable enough that we can discover the truth in science. Presumably, there are certain moral imperatives that we think we ought to try and discover the truth about our universe. And these deeper questions of why we're justified in believing in any moral imperatives or trusting our own reason, they are one of the things which theism is very much relevant to.
You asked early in our conversation one of those questions, why is there an orderly universe that we can discover and explore, even if only in theory? I have, you know, done some reading in this, and the question is raised by theoretical physicists, why is there something rather than nothing, which is kind of a simple way of asking that question. And rather than answering the question, almost to a person, they say, well, if there weren't, we wouldn't be around to ask the question. But I've never found a satisfactory answer to that question.
That's good, because it isn't actually an explanation. It's like the same way that they'll handle fine-tuning. They would say, well, if the universe weren't fine-tuned, then we wouldn't be alive and we wouldn't be able to discuss it. But, of course, that doesn't give any explanation of why it is fine-tuned. John Leslie gives the example, if there were 50 sharpshooters and they were going to assassinate you and they all missed, you wouldn't find it satisfactory an explanation of their all missing that, well, if they hadn't missed, you wouldn't be here. And the same thing applies, I think, to ducking the cosmological argument. It's very intuitively plausible. The famous simple version of the argument, if anything begins to exist, it has a cause. The universe began to exist, so the universe had a cause. That's verified in all of our experience. So that, for example, if a unicorn would appear right now in the studio with you, Todd, out of nowhere, that would violate all of our experience. And this is one of the reasons it would be a rather alarming experience that we wouldn't know how to make any sense of. So when people say that the universe arose out of absolutely nothing, do they really mean nothing at all? From nothing, nothing comes, seems to be verified by all our actual experience. If they mean from nothing except the laws, on the other hand, well, laws aren't nothing. They contain information that shapes what happens. They say, well, if you have this kind of event, then you get this other kind of event. And so trying to explain things in terms of laws doesn't really get you to nothing at all. Then one wants to know, well, why is the universe governed by laws? And then, in fact, laws also don't really create anything. All the law will really do is map certain events onto other events, which doesn't explain why there are any events at all.
It seems as though Hawking's theory, as you explained it earlier, is, okay, we occupy this universe with this set of laws and this progression from what we would consider to be a beginning of sorts to where we are now. And he would say, well, the reason that it's all worked out so beautifully for us and that we can peer into space and theorize and things like that is because there's an infinite number of possibilities that have that are all being played out all the time. And that sounds like such a convenient theory to say, well, I got an explanation for it. Every possibility is happening. We just happen to be in the one that's working out the way that we observe it to be working out. That seems such a convenient theory.
Yeah, it's sometimes called the inflationary fallacy because you can make anything, no matter how improbable, probable, simply by calling attention to an infinite resource. And, of course, the problem is that's only going to be legitimate in science if you have good reason to believe that that resource exists. Do we have good independent reason to believe in the existence of these other universes or histories?
Isn't that just as fanciful as the God explanation?
Well, it's more fanciful because the God explanation, after all, is very economical. You have one personal cause.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I'll let you finish your thought there. Dr. Angus Manoogia is our guest. We're talking about recent statements made by scientist Stephen Hawking about science and God. Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
How would you like to win a $50 gift certificate to Concordia Publishing House? There are two ways you can win. One, write the best invitation to your Facebook friends to become fans at the Issues Etc. Facebook page. Or two, invite the most friends to become fans at our Facebook page. Send an email to contest@issuesetc.org with the text of your invitation and the number of friends you invited. We'll give away the CPH gift certificates October 1st. Invite your Facebook friends to become our fans today.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The Gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the Gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
People want to think there is something they can relate to, and which can make them feel they are not isolated, but are part of the larger whole.
Again, Stephen Hawking talking about his explanation for why people believe in God. Dr. Angus Mnuchin is our guest for about another 15 minutes in this first hour of Issues, Etc. on this Friday, September the 10th. Dr. Mnuchin, before the break, you were contrasting the fanciful theories that would posit an infinite number of possibilities all being worked out and leading to the circumstances we find ourselves in with the explanation that puts God at the head of all of it. And you said that the God explanation is actually more efficient.
Yeah, because ultimately you still need a sufficient reason for any contingent thing to exist rather than nothing. That's Leibniz's version, the principle of a sufficient reason. And if you have one necessary being, a perfect, eternal God, then he is able to explain the existence of any contingent thing. And then, in fact, you only need this one universe, the one that we have evidence for existing, and you don't need to postulate these other universes. You can certainly believe in other possible worlds, okay? In other words, in philosophy, we talk about possible things that might have happened, but you don't have to reify those and actually say that they are realities like this one. And that seems to be much more in accord with Occam's razor, which says do not multiply entities beyond necessity, one God rather than an infinite stream of histories or universes.
Isn't part of the problem here that, not to get too technical, that quantum theory has raised far more questions than it's really been able to answer, and the questions it raises all tend toward this all possible worlds existing simultaneously, whether it be an electron zipping through the universe. Quantum theory will tell you that it not only could take any path to its objective, it does take every path to its objective. Doesn't the theory itself kind of lead to this kind of speculation and dreaming about what could be?
Well, it does say that at a particular time that you are measuring a particle, there can be what's called a superposition of states. However, it also says that when you measure it, there's a collapse of the wave function, and it's in one definite location or another. So when you're firing one of these particles through a tube in an apparatus, you can't locate its exact position in transit. But when it reaches the screen at the back, it's in one definite location. And so it seems that, yes, there is openness in the development of history. But on the other hand, when things finally happen, they happen in a quite definite way. So it doesn't seem to me that really justifies the idea that there really are these parallel histories going on all of the time. In fact, Everett's hypothesis is viewed as very extravagant, according to most quantum theorists.
You mentioned before information, and that's one of the things that, as a layperson, it helped me understand kind of a basic framework for looking at whether it's the scientific theories or, in fact, the intelligent design view of the universe. What role does information or information systems play in bolstering the notion of one cause in the universe?
Well, the laws themselves include information because, you know, they specify what will happen under certain circumstances. And so one has to ask, where is that information coming from? If we think of the laws as guiding the development or the unfolding of history, well, the information in those laws has to come from somewhere, just as the information in DNA has to come from somewhere. In our experience, new information comes from an intelligent author. This is why, you know, we look to composers and authors for new ideas, including the brilliant ideas of Hawking himself.
How do scientists like Hawking explain the existence of information?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, he talks about things developing spontaneously, but it seems to me that's really just talking about the development of the universe itself. In the background, there's the information in the laws that specifies how that happens. It seems to me, therefore, that he's really displaced the problem. If we forget about the laws, it seems as if the laws can do it all by themselves, but then one asks, where do the laws come from? Sometimes it seems to me that secularists are therefore a bit like the person who stabs the swordsmith with the sword and then says, well, clearly then, swords don't need swordsmiths.
Is there any explanation offered by the present day theories for how it is that we can? This kind of goes back to an old philosophical argument. How it is that we can even have an idea of God? Hawking says people have to have a need for something beyond themselves, something they fit into for a sense of purpose. Is this the only explanation they're offering for why people believe in God?
Well, if you broaden it and you bring in people like Dawkins and so forth, he'll tell you about, you know, the idea of the God delusion and that somehow that it's useful to have an idea of God for cooperation. So there are various secular theories. But the problem is that merely arguing that people want something to be true has no bearing whatsoever on whether or not it is true. Somebody might want to be paid at the end of the month, and then they are, so it was true. Or they might not be, so it was false. There's no real connection. And further, it seems to be naive about the reality of the human condition, as we understand it from Scripture, is that actually people have a powerful natural desire to deny God's existence, and they don't really want God to exist. They'd rather be the author of everything. And I can't help thinking that when Hawking talks about this grand design, the idea of a final theory that explains everything. Doesn't that appeal at some level to the scientist's desire to be a bit like God, to have a complete picture of all of reality?
It sounds an awful lot like a desire to find a final explanation. But if what Hawking says is true, such a search is fruitless, isn't it?
Well, you'd wonder how he can believe that human beings are capable of discovering the final truth. On his view, if the natural universe is all there is, then all he should be able to predict is that he has a mind that's useful for getting around, for survival. And as many philosophers have pointed out, you can have useful beliefs that are mostly false. What makes them useful is they lead to useful behaviors, like finding food or running away from lions. It doesn't matter whether they're true or not. You could believe that a lion is a shrubbery. As long as you run away from the lion, then you survive for another day. Well, if that's the kind of mind he has, why should he suppose that he's capable of solving grandiose questions about the nature and origin of the entire universe? That surely has nothing to do with our survival on this planet.
So make the case for us, Dr. Manoj, if you would, that contrary to what Stephen Hawking and others have suggested, science has not rendered God unnecessary.
Science, I think, historically and philosophically depends on God. The early scientists of the modern revolution believed there would be laws of nature precisely because they believed there was a creator God who had inscribed rational orders, rational laws of nature. And they also believed that they had been able to discover it because they believed that they were made in the image of God. And so there would be some kind of affinity between the reason in their own mind and the reason of the laws of nature. So the idea of God in the background, it makes you believe nature is reliable and my mind is reliable, and I may be able to find out what those laws are. Take God out of the picture, and now there's no particular reason why nature shouldn't be chaotic, and there's no reason why our minds should not really just be useful, but not really truth-oriented.
Dr. Angus Manoj is professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's editor of the book Reading God's World, The Scientific Vocation. You can find a link to this book at our website, under the Listen On Demand page, issuesetc.org. Dr. Manoj, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Todd. Glad to be on.
Coming up in the second hour of the program on this Friday afternoon, September the 10th, we will conclude our series on the Apostles' Creed. Dr. Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, will be with us. We'll follow the Creed to its conclusion. In the third part of the Creed, the subject is the Holy Spirit, the Holy Christian Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. We'll cover all of that in the second hour of Issues, etc. on this Friday afternoon. There are marvels in the world that God has made and put us in that do defy not only imagination, but our knowledge. It only stands to reason that our knowledge would be limited, since the creation comes from the mind greater than ours. But to deny God is not only to deny simple things like a first cause. It is to deny the very one who gave us the minds to discover our world around us in the first place. I'm Todd Wilkin. When we come back in 7 minutes, hour two of Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.